Pat Riley has had a storied career in the world of professional basketball. He's the first North American sports figure in any sport to win a championship as a player, as an assistant coach, as a head coach, and as a team president or executive. In his book, Riley tells the story, though, of one of his most regrettable coaching seasons. He was new as a coach. In fact, he was the assistant coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. In 1980, they won the world championship. They were heavily favored to sort of sweep the 81 season. They had players like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Many of you guys are old enough to remember him. And a rookie by the name of Magic Johnson. Within weeks of their 81 season opener, this star rookie, Magic Johnson, tore some cartilage and was out for several months. Undeterred, the team rallied together. They pressed on. To the surprise of many in the sports world, they won 70% of their next games. Well, at the end of 3 months, Johnson was cleared to come back on the court, and the basketball world was elated. In fact, they focused more attention on what the team could do when he returned than what the team had done when he was away. Of course, other players, all of them fairly talented as well, didn't appreciate the shift in publicity. And over time, especially as the time of his return drew near, they became resentful and jealous, and the team was riddled with disunity. The night Magic Johnson returned to the lineup, Riley wrote, it was filled with excitement. The stadium was sold out. The ovations when he appeared were long and loud. The fans assumed that now they would be undefeatable, now that their star had returned. Well, that night, the Lakers barely squeaked out a victory, even though they played a far inferior team, not nearly as talented, and the season just sort of went downhill from there. Team morale collapsed. The head coach was fired, as well as the general manager. Riley was appointed as the new head coach, and none of that really seemed to help. In fact, the season ended rather dismally. Riley made this interesting observation about this season. He writes this, because of pettiness and resentment, we executed one of the fastest falls in NBA history. And then he kind of coined this phrase. He said, and it was all because of the disease of me. He coined that phrase for all the players who focused on themselves, their stats, their public image, and in so doing, the team failed to deliver. The truth is, a team sport, frankly, any team sport, the word me doesn't work that well. The word us is the word that matters. One professional athlete said recently, and it caught my attention, said this, teams with a star player win games, rarely do they win championships. I find it fascinating, beloved, that the Apostle Paul is going to make a direct connection between a sports team and the local church in order to challenge them and us of what it looks like to act as a teammate, belonging not only to Jesus Christ, but to each other. Now, in the final paragraph of this chapter, we're in Philippians chapter 1, he drives home the main point of his entire letter. In fact, we began to unpack that main idea in our last study together. Let's go back to verse 27 of chapter 1, where Paul writes, only, that is, keep this in mind now, this one thing, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or remain absent, I may hear, that is, he's saying, I may hear this about you. Now stop for a moment. Here's where Paul is about to deliver several aspects of good conduct worthy of the gospel. And the first one we covered in our study, and that is this. He says, I want to hear about you that you are committed to repairing a disunifying spirit. Notice, he says, that I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit. Standing firm is a word that Paul uses. It provides a word picture. It's a metaphor for an army. Unified as one source. Strength in unified numbers. Like an unbreakable bundle of pencils. Remember in our demonstration, one pencil was easily broken. Four pencils were easily broken. And even a dozen pencils were unexpectedly, miraculously broken, but not that bundle of 36 pencils. There's strength in numbers, especially in unified numbers. Which is why, of course, the enemy attempts to deceive and distract and ultimately divide and conquer, discourage, derail. But the church, unified, advances the gospel. So first, Paul writes, we are to stand firm in one spirit. Which, by the way, means that you stay alert for any form of disunity and you seek to repair it. Now, that's the first aspect of living a life worthy of the gospel of Christ, worthy of your citizenship belonging to the kingdom of God. Now, there are two more aspects in this final paragraph. We're going to cover one more today. Paul effectively writes, I not only want to hear that you are repairing a disunifying spirit, I also want to hear, secondly, that you are rejecting a disengaging attitude. In other words, you're going to refuse to live and act and worship in isolation. That it's just going to be about you. Notice the last part of verse 27. With one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. I find it interesting. Paul uses, again, another word picture for us. He changes his metaphor from that of an army standing firm to that of a team, an athletic team, specifically, working together. It's the word striving together there in the text. We'll look at that more in a moment. In this last phrase here, Paul is effectively describing, he is defining teamwork and the teamwork of a local church. Now, if we look closely at not only the word picture, but this phrase, we can break it down and in so doing, break down his definition of what it means to be a good teammate. Let me give them to you. First of all, Paul emphasizes that a team is committed to the same desire. Paul emphasizes the church is moving forward. Notice, with one mind. That's the word psuche. You can translate it soul. One psuche. One linguist writes that this word here in this context indicates the mind or the soul is the seat of sensation, passion, desire. So a team that works together as good teammates with good teamwork is literally one psuche, one sensation, one desire. They are one psyche. Of course, the team that works well together is exactly this. We think about it even today. We use the expression that team is psyched up for the game. They have one mind. And one passion. Before the football game, perhaps this afternoon, if you're going to watch it, you're going to find men jumping up and down on the sidelines. The captain's yelling out this cheer and they're yelling it back to him. Men 300 pounds and more holding hands like little school children as they cheer together. They are psyched up for the game as they play together. By the way, pros that compete in individual sporting events will tell you that one of the most difficult parts of their game is that very fact. They are acting as individuals. They're playing alone. What an incredible advantage to play in partnership with other teammates who have the same psyche, that is, the same desire. In our culture today, we might look at a team as a team dedicated to one desire. That one desire is going to be scoring a goal or putting that puck in the net or a soccer ball in the net. It might be bringing one more player than the opposing team across home plate. And everything about that team, its management, its budget, its strategy is designed ultimately to get one more player than the other team to touch home plate. Or one desire which would be to score a touchdown. Everything is concentrated to see that happen. I mean, today, if you're going to watch any football, the entire Green Bay Packer team is going to be committed in their unified desire of scoring more touchdowns than the Seahawks. Then later on tonight, you're going to be in church, you'll miss most of it, but at any rate, it's going to be the Colts. The Colts are going to be unified in their desire to defeat the New England Patriots, which I am hoping is the will of God. Which means Super Bowl 49 will be between the Packers and the Colts, and the Packers are going to win by 13 points. It's in chapter 37 of the book of Philippians, right there. You're going to find out today I'm not a prophet. One thing we do know, every team that's going to get fielded today are coming out with a unified desire, the same mind, the same psyche. And Paul, by the way, pulls from that world and says, here you go, church. Here's your passion. Here's a demonstration of your desire. How excited do we get about that? I love coming together with you and being excited about the rehearsal of what we believe about the gospel. Paul says that's the church. One mind. Now imagine for just a moment what this is going to mean in impacting their lives individually before it ever impacts anybody else's life. As different as we are, I mean, I just mentioned four teams, and I'll bet you anything our church is divided four different ways, right? Different accents, different nations of origin, different backgrounds, different education. The church, as Paul puts it, is living in a manner that reveals we belong to the same king, the same kingdom. And this little outpost, this particular one here, the same local church. We belong to each other. Beloved, being a Christian doesn't mean that we're going to live perfectly. But it should mean that we live differently. Differently. And imagine how the original charter members of the Church of Philippi acted differently. If I can just for a moment take you back to that introduction of this letter where Paul and Silas go to Philippi, first time the gospel reaches there and they ultimately plant a church. And you may remember that the first convert is this successful businesswoman named Lydia, who immediately opens up her palatial home, which is the place where the church will meet for their worship services. It isn't long after that that a slave girl who has been demonized, controlled by demons, that Paul will deliver her from. But she's become a new believer. And because this little demonized young lady is no longer any benefit to her fortune-telling masters, her masters accuse Paul and Silas of spreading revolutionary truths and has them arrested. You may know, of course, what happens in that jail cell at midnight. Paul and Silas are singing, right? And God shakes that prison and all their chains fall off. Ultimately, the prison warden and his family who hears and believes the gospel are saved. Now, think about this. How in the world is a polished, wealthy businesswoman ever going to relate to a former demonized young lady? And how are either one of these women going to relate to a prison warden who with his family lives at the city jail? There's your church plant. It couldn't be any different. But they demonstrate the fact that they have not only joined the same family, but they're playing on the same team with the same love and desire for the gospel. That's how it happens. Any team in the athletic world is made up of all sorts of talent and skill and background and size and weight and training and focus. But they have the same psuche, the same desire, the same passion to advance the glory and gospel of Christ. I can remember, by the way, getting a letter some time ago from a woman who joined our church. She and her husband, a successful executive with a firm in our area. When they moved into our town, began looking for a church, they did the research and found that they agreed with our doctrinal statement, our philosophy of ministry and everything about us, and decided to make their visit. She would write me that after that first visit, they decided this would be their church. And she wrote it would be something in addition to that sort of sealed the deal in relation to who we were. And it wasn't just our doctrine and our philosophy of ministry. She said, the Sunday they visited, they were struck by the beauty of the facilities, friendliness of people, the excellence in the materials they received. They sat in one of the back sections where many people long to sit. And while back there, they sat directly behind another couple about their age. During the service, the man put his arm around his wife's shoulders, directly in front of them. And when he did, she and her husband noticed that his calloused hand, a few cuts, some bruises, and fingernails had been scrubbed. But still, it showed the tinge of black grease under his fingernails from obvious hours spent working in a repair shop. She wrote, we looked at each other, my husband and I, and knew that a church that welcomed all walks of life like this would be their church. Isn't that great? This is the local church with so many people committed to one mind. So how do we get along? How are we doing? This is to be the same team where a white-collar guy and a blue-collar guy can sacrificially give and pray toward the same goal. Where the Mexican and the Portuguese can serve together. Where the white man and the black man can pray together in the same Bible study. Where the doctor makes coffee in a classroom while the mechanic gets ready to teach. Where the businesswoman invites a housewife to coffee. Where a homeschooling mom develops a friendship with the wife of a public school principal. Where an old man determines to understand the young man. Where the young man decides to place value in the old man. Where the single adult appreciates the church's ministries to couples. Where the childless pray for parents. Where the widow volunteers in the nursery. Where the CEO serves as an usher. Where the drummer thanks God for the violinist. Well, that's a stretch. Where the violinist thanks God for the drummer. Where PhDers attend an adult Bible fellowship class taught by a college dropout. See, the church is a living demonstration of grace. We don't live perfectly, but we should live differently because of the grace we've received. This is being of one psuche, one devotion, one desire. That's a team. Secondly, a team is not only committed to the same desire, but a team is moving in the same direction. Now, this is where Paul specifically uses this metaphor of athletics for this phrase, which sent my mind racing along this path. Notice as he writes, with one mind striving together. Those words, striving together, is one compound original word, soon athleo. Soon, the prefix, with, side by side, athleo, which gives us our word, athletics. Athlete. The compound word provides then the word picture in the mind of Paul of a team of athletes working together. And this gives us the concept then of teamwork. In fact, one linguist in his wonderful language work published this year by the name of Stephen Runge, he translates this doing something side by side. It's a good picture of teamwork. Paul is encouraging the church to act as a team, moving with the same desire in the same direction, which is good for a team to do, right? Be moving toward the same goal. One commentator called it selfless solidarity. I love that term. It's what the church ought to be. Selfless solidarity. Demonstrating team effort. Teamwork. And let's not forget team spirit. When I thought about this metaphor, I kind of just propped my legs up on my desk at home and began to think through ways Paul would have viewed first century athletic teams and what would relate across the centuries, and really it's timeless relationships, analogies. I began to think, what does it mean to be a good teammate? Several things came to my mind. First, a good teammate offers ongoing encouragement, even when you're not doing all that well. I mean, on the basketball court, that guy puts up a three-pointer and it swishes. His opponent is not going to stop and go, man, that was a great shot. Wow, give me a high five. No. Opponents don't do that. Teammates do. It even struck me, secondly, that a good teammate is willing to cheer from the bench. He might not be the starter. He might be the backup quarterback. And those guys, by the way, if I ever watch a game, impress me because they got the headphones on. They're by the coach and they call a timeout. The starting quarterback comes out and this guy's right there encouraging him. That's tough to do, though, isn't it? Cheer somebody on. I can remember in middle school playing on the school basketball team. I wasn't a starter, too short. I was what you would call the sixth man. What that meant was, as soon as the point guard got tired, needed a break, or if he wasn't doing all that well, the coach would yell, Davey, get in there. So what do you think I was thinking on the bench about that starting guard? He put up a shot. Swish. Yay. Way to go. And he's on fire. I'll never get in there. A good teammate cheers from the bench. Another thought came to my mind. A good teammate understands, as I've said earlier, I'll say it this way, that the word us is more important than the word me. You ever played on a team and you knew one of those guys or gals, it was all about them. Further, a good teammate recognizes that every position on the team is critical. It isn't just their position. Defense is as critical as offense. They usually don't get to spike the football in the end zone, in that glorious moment. But without them, the offense would never get the chance to do that. Here's another. A good teammate sacrifices his comfort for the advancement of the team. He's gonna slug it out, sweat it out, play his role. He'll give everything he's got. Many of you are gonna do that today. For the sake of this team, sacrifice your own comfort and convenience and serve in some way. Many of you already have. One more. A good teammate is willing to accept the assignment of his coach. Warren Wiersbe writes, not everyone can be a captain or a quarterback. Every player can't be a wide receiver or a three-pointer or the striker on the soccer team. Someone has coached them, trained them, evaluated them, and assigned them to the position they play. And they willingly play the role. In this analogy, God trains, equips, and assigns. He has designs and makes assignments so that we play a role on the team. He's equipped us. He's trained us. He's prepared us. He continues to work in us and wants to use us, and he assigns us on the playing field. So if it's God's assignment, then there's no such thing as promotions in the church. The church is not a ladder. I'm going to climb my way up, wherever up happens to be. That's the world out there, not the church. In fact, Paul will use the analogy of the human body to stress this point as he tells the Corinthian church that every part of the body is an assignment from God that helps the body to function. Some parts are out of sight, some visible. He writes it this way. Let me take time just to read a few verses. He says it this way. For the body is not one part or member, but many. If the foot shall say, well, because I'm not the hand, I'm not a part of the body, is it not any less a part of the body? And if the ear should say, I'm not an eye, I'm not a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the hearing be? And if the whole body were hearing, where would the sense of smell be? In other words, nobody is volunteering to be a nose. Who wants to be a nose? I want to be an eye. I want to see all the action. I want to be a hand. I want to be in the action. I don't want to be a foot that's covered up. I want to be there in the middle of it. Here's the point to keep in mind. Paul writes to the Corinthians this, but now God has placed the members, each one of them, in the body just as he desired. That's why you're serving where you're serving. Ultimately, it's God's desire. So stop vying to be a hand if God's made you an ear. Stop trying to be an eye if God has prepared you and assigned you to be a foot. Come to terms with what God has been and is doing in your life. As I thought about those middle school years, I couldn't help but remember, in fact, I remember, frankly, being upset with God's design. Short and skinny. I'm still skinny, but I'm not short. Frankie, the neighborhood bully, would pummel me. In fact, one time my mother had to rescue me as he pummeled me in front of all the neighborhood kids. That took years to grow out of, to get over. Counseling, seminary, the whole thing, so that I could go into the pastorate. I remember not long after getting pummeled by Frankie, I saw an advertisement about bodybuilding powder. You added that to whatever you were drinking. I know some of you guys have done that too. You won't admit it. The big canister had a picture on it with a guy flexing his biceps. And I knew as a middle schooler that was what my life was missing. And so my sweet mother went along every night for several months, made me a milkshake and added this powder to it so that I could put on weight. It looked like sawdust. It felt like sawdust. And it tasted like sawdust. I never gained 1 pound, and I finally gave it up. In fact, I would go on. When I got married to my bride 33 years ago, I had a 29-inch waist. A 29-inch waist. Now it's a 30. No, the truth is, like you, I can today gain a pound just being in the same room with a milkshake. Just looking at it. Boop, there goes another pound. Listen, as a child, part of maturing and part of growing up is coming to terms with how God made you. And for some of us, it's a tough time. The same is true spiritually. Spiritual growth is coming to terms with the way God equipped you and gifted you and assigned you, but may I remind you, here's the good news. God did the equipping. God did the planning. God does the assigning. And every assignment is critical to the team. As we move together in the same direction, side by side, with the same desire to advance the gospel and glory of Christ. So a team and teamwork, in the words of Paul's metaphor, athletes together, number one, we're committed to the same desire. That's one mind, one psuche. We're moving in the same direction, striving together. Thirdly, a team is delivering the same declaration. Look at the last part of verse 27. Striving together for the faith of the gospel. This phrase, for the faith of the gospel, appears only here in this form in the New Testament. And it's difficult to nail exactly down what Paul has in mind. He probably has everything in mind that I'm about to give you. But Paul might have in mind the idea of striving together as we have placed our faith in the gospel. Or striving together for the faith which is the gospel. Or our faith generates or is generated by the gospel. He might have all of these in mind. So in other words, as a church, we are committed to the same desire. We are moving together in the same direction to declare and deliver to our world the same gospel, which is by faith alone. A gospel which produces faith. A gospel which is the result of faith, a gospel that reinforces our faith. And by the way, in so doing, this is where we get into trouble. Because the world may not necessarily appreciate our declaration of one gospel. And by the way, I get a little queasy when I hear church leaders out there and I read statements by church leaders talking about many faiths. Beloved, there are not many faiths. There is one faith. Everything else is tragic speculation. There are not many lords. There's one true and living Lord. And that's going to lead us into this third aspect of what it means to live in a manner worthy of the gospel. Paul called it the gospel of Christ. In Galatians 1:7, to Timothy, he said, we have been entrusted by this glorious gospel of God. 1 Timothy 1:11. So the church is effectively a team effort to deliver and declare to our world the saving gospel of faith in Jesus Christ. We don't hedge that. We don't compromise that. We've been told to deliver that. Paul has already, in fact, told the Philippian church that they are going to share in his reward, his gospel ministry. They're in a different location, but they're praying for him and they're supporting him. Paul views himself, along with the Philippian church, as effectively being on a team together, delivering the gospel of grace. As I did a little research about sporting events and athletic competitions, I came across one sporting event that I normally don't think of as a team sport, and it's only because I'm really not that educated in it, but that's professional auto racing. However, I learned how critically important a team effort is. Even though it's one man behind the wheel, it takes a team to win. And I tread on ground. Some of you may know a lot about it, and I'm just going to give you a few things I learned. And by the way, in the lobby after the second hour, a guy comes up to me and he says, by the way, I appreciated your illustration on racing because my cousin is Cale Yarborough. And I said, well, did I say it right? He said, let's have lunch. No, he said, I got it right. One of the key elements of a successful race is the teamwork of a pit crew. For instance, I read this. In 1950, one article read, an Indy pit crew consisted of four men, which included the driver. He had to get out, run around, and help them. Okay? A routine pit stop to replace two tires and fill the tank back then took around 60 seconds, which to me is still really fast. Today, a crew consists of 11 members, excluding the driver. He gets to stay behind the wheel now. Six are permitted direct contact with the car. Five serve as behind-the-wall assistants. I didn't know what that meant. I'm going to learn over lunch here a little bit. A full-service pit stop, get this, that replaces all four tires, fills the gas tank, now takes 8 seconds. 8 seconds. Now, Formula One pit crews are even larger, sometimes involving 20 people, and they all have one role to play. And when everyone, this article, secular article says this, when everyone understands his role, and when everyone on the pit crew, listen to this, does his job with purpose and passion, the team can complete the same job in under 3 seconds. Every member with an assignment, every member with purpose and passion, every member dedicated to one mission, get that car back on the track. The analogies are obvious. Where's your place in the pit crew? And can you imagine the analogy in the mind of Paul back to his athletic contest that he would expect us to have that kind of passion for this family? This one desire. This direction and declaration. For the gospel and glory of Christ. This is living in a manner worthy of the gospel. So far we have heard from the Spirit of God through Paul the Apostle that we are to repair any disunifying spirit that will crush us. Secondly, we are to reject any disengaging attitude. Well, I'm just going to be my own team made up of one. That will crush us. The third aspect shows how, because of this, we can face trouble. With this, I close. Haddon Robinson, a man who's preached for me in recent years, told of a visit a man he knew made. This man made a visit to an asylum for the criminally insane. During his visit, he was surprised at the small number of guards, three of them, in an open area where these mentally ill inmates gathered, and there were nearly 100 of them. Finally, he asked one of the guards, "Aren't you afraid? Aren't you afraid that these inmates will unite, overcome you, escape?" The guard responded, "No, no. Mentally insane inmates never unite. They don't know how." Robinson goes on to say, Christians do and should. Let's refuse the temptation to disengage. Don't buy into the insanity of our world that living for yourself in the church, serving yourself in the church, focusing on yourself in the church, will ever accomplish anything. Let's engage. You have an appointment to fill. Where is it? As we as a church demonstrate teamwork, which is commitment, we are committing to the same desire. One mind, moving in the same direction, striving together, delivering to our world the same declaration, which is the gospel of Jesus Christ.